I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. France is reeling from yet another terrorist attack, this time in Nice on Bastille Day, July 14th. A man driving a truck mowed down pedestrians on the Promenade des Anglais after watching fireworks. He was shot and killed by the police. The carnage is horrifying. More than 80 killed, many injured, dozens critically injured. Now, there is much that we do not know at this time, but nonetheless a disturbing trend. And we asked Delaware Senator Chris Coons to join us on Radio Times. He's a member of a number of committees, including the Foreign Relations Committee. And Senator Coons, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Always grateful for a chance to be on with you, but so sorry to be once again discussing a tragic large-scale terrorist attack in France.
Absolutely. Why France? And I'm thinking of the attack on the concert, the attack on the headquarters of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. Is France uniquely identified by terrorists?
No, I don't think France is uniquely a target of terrorism, although there are some reasons why the three major attacks in the last year have happened in France. France is a particularly open Western liberal society. And the liberties that are enjoyed in France are particularly enraging to the sort of bizarre worldview of the Islamic State and of extremist jihadists. But they also have a large French Muslim immigrant population from countries that were former French colonies, Algeria, Tunisia, Senegal, elsewhere. Early reports suggest that the attacker in Nice was a 31-year-old, a French citizen of Tunisian descent, and France has had a greater difficulty in fully integrating and including in their society French citizens of African or Arabic or Muslim descent. So there is some possibility that the greater risks of terrorism in France are partly because of the diversity of their nation and partly because of their culture of openness. It was particularly tragic that this large-scale attack happened on Bastille Day, at a time and a place where the French were gathering to celebrate, one of their most important national holidays, and a holiday that's committed to, liberty and equality and brotherhood. And the means of the terrorist attack was sort of particularly blunt and graphic and horrific, not particularly sophisticated, and something that would be very hard to protect against.
Well, and picking up on what you just said, the idea of a truck as a weapon, does this signify a different kind of terrorism?
I think it's just a continuation of the new wave of terrorism we've seen in recent years, where folks are willing to make themselves into bombs, to be suicide bombers, or are willing to use almost any tool available. I don't remember any comparable incident in recent years, and it does suggest that we're going to have to redouble our efforts to make sure that so-called soft targets, that civilian areas in the Western world, are hardened against attack. But it's hard to imagine how you could have done a better job protecting against this particular attack in Nice. We do need to strengthen our intelligence capabilities and our information sharing with the French intelligence services. And I do think we need to continue to press the attack against the Islamic State. Our national security leaders have predicted that as our campaign against ISIS picks up speed, gets stronger as they're losing territory, as their leaders are being killed on the battlefield, as we're restricting the flow of foreign fighters into the territory that ISIS still controls, their tactics will get more extreme. They will get more aggressive. And they will take more action against the civilians in Western societies.
But do we know that ISIS is behind this? I don't believe at this point that anyone has claimed responsibility for the attack. The man has been identified as Mohammed Boulal, and the little bit that I read about him this morning, you said from Tunisia, seemed to have a history of petty crime, was going through a divorce. Some of the people that knew him, I'm seeing a quote in the Daily Telegraph, he was more into women than into religion. Do we know enough about this man to know whether he was operating as part of ISIS?
We don't. And Marty, let me make sure I was being a little sloppy there in my comments. He did not do anything publicly that we know of yet to claim inspiration by ISIS. I was just suggesting that there have been a series of attacks in a number of countries by similar lone wolf, angry, aggressive individuals who seem to have been radicalized by their concerns about what's happening with ISIS and in the Muslim world, but where they themselves receive no training, no equipment, no direct connection to ISIS. So I was speaking in a shorthand there earlier, much as the attacks in San Bernardino and in Orlando didn't seem to have any direct connection to ISIS other than an expression of sympathy and support from a radicalized lone actor. My gut hunch right now is that this will evolve in a similar way, but I do not know that, and there's no public knowledge about that yet, so I shouldn't have jumped to that conclusion. But you are asking why France in particular, why France might be a target of terrorism, and I think the combination of the Bataclan attacks, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and this one seem to have a common pattern of radicalized French citizens or Belgian citizens who are personally deeply affected and upset by the campaign against ISIS.
Well, final question, and it raises this, of course, raises questions about if there's anything more the United States should do. Hillary Clinton said today that there should be better information sharing, or perhaps even said this last night, to improve counterterrorism efforts. Should the U.S. be doing anything differently?
We do need to step up our insistence on better coordination across the EU and with our European allies. We learned, I believe, from the Brussels attacks that there are some European security and intelligence services that have not been sharing with each other and sharing with us as much as they could. And I understand the respect for privacy and concerns about the balance between civil liberties, privacy, and security. But there were some public comments about the lack of close coordination with the intelligence services in France and in Belgium after attacks earlier this year. That suggests to me that there's work that still needs to be done in that area.
Well, Senator Chris Coons, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, especially during your vacation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty. Always good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Delaware Senator Chris Coons talking about the attack in Nice, France. And do stay with WHYY throughout the day as we learn more about what happened. Well, about a year ago, when Donald Trump descended the escalator at Trump Tower to announce that he was running for president, it was dismissed largely as a publicity stunt. Next week in Cleveland, it looks like he will be the Republican Party's nominee for president after beating a crowded field of candidates. His candidacy has divided the GOP with some high-profile defections and a number of senators saying they will be too busy to attend the convention. In fact, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake said he will be mowing his lawn next week. It's been a surprising and tumultuous campaign season, and our guests Dave Davies and Dick Pullman have been covering it. In fact, they'll be reporting for WHYY, including Radio Times, next week from the RNC in Cleveland. Dave is senior reporter here at WHYY. You can read his blog off mic at newsworks.org. And Dave, always a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back, Marty.
Nice to have you back. Dick Pullman writes the National Interest blog at newsworks.org, and he's writer in residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Dave, how are you preparing for Cleveland?
Trying to get the lay of the land. I discovered I need four different sets of credentials that I'll have to pick up at various places in Cleveland, and there's a fifth that I did not bother to apply for.
Oh, dear.
But it's mostly trying to figure out what stories I want to get and how to find them.
Right. And you'll be following, in many ways, a Pennsylvania delegation that will obviously be in Cleveland.
Yeah. I'll be staying at the same hotel they are and kind of tracking them. It's interesting that the Pennsylvania delegation is mostly officially uncommitted, and there are a lot of people there. 54 of the 71 delegates are officially uncommitted, and there are many who will vote for Trump out of a sense of loyalty and respect for what statewide voters, the decision they made in the April 26 primary, but they are themselves quite ambivalent about all this.
Oh, that's interesting.
They don't say it on the record quite so readily, but it'll be interesting to see how they feel about all that happens. And then there are a set of zealots, people who are just all in for Trump, including some who we've reported on are going to be bringing weapons, and that'll be another interesting story to follow. So I'll be on top of all that and just looking for kind of the story in its at its base level. You know, we're going to have terrific coverage from our national team at NPR. They're going to cover the gavel and the national story. I want to kind of get the texture of what's happening on the ground.
Let me turn to you, Dick. This is your ninth political convention, so congratulations on that. So you are a veteran here. I've only done one, and this was in 2000 when the Republicans were in town. And it's clear that the party is trying to get out a message. I mean, this is what a convention is all about. What will you be looking for? And how do you want to get around that message?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to be, because I write opinion, I'm going to be trying to sort of, I'm going to try to keep the big picture in mind. What is the big picture narrative? But I'm also going to be looking for sort of, you know, smaller ground level moments that I can perhaps witness and experience that I can roll into the big picture as I see fit. You know, usually I write once a day and post it late morning. But I'm actually going to, you know, vary that schedule this time because things are going to be happening all day and all night. And so I might be just popping smaller pieces during the day and maybe a bigger piece at night because that's when the speeches happen.
Right.
So I'll probably be trying to sort of connect the dots of what I see there. But, you know, their overall message is going to be, well, first of all, they want to at least put together some kind of – they want to convey unity. And at least in some nominal way, they managed to achieve some of it last night when they snuffed out – I'm talking about the Trump forces and the Republican National Committee. They snuffed out a last-minute effort by Stop Trump delegates to free up delegates on the floor to be able to vote their conscience. In other words, to say, oh, we don't care. We don't have to abide by the results of the primaries. But that died. And so, you know, there's going to at least be some kind of surface unity. The problem is that what I see so far is if you look at the and I'm sure Dave has, if you look at the list of speakers, it's more interesting to see who's not on it. In other words, almost all of the sort of all of the diverse, as a matter of fact, women, people of color, future stars of the party from Nikki Haley, you know, and some of the women in particular are not.
They're not there.
They're not there. They're not on the speaker schedule. And so you've got, you know, there's a couple grade B celebrities there. There's a martial arts expert.
Tim Tebow will not be there.
Tim Tebow will not be. Well, this is the other problem.
Or Tom Brady or Serena Williams.
Or Tom Brady,
All these people that were
Serena
floated
Williams,
are not showing up. So, you know, you've got – and if you look at that list, it's almost 100% white. And as is pretty much the delegation. And, you know, the Republicans have had trouble with that in other years. But I'm not sure that's necessarily the message they want to put out, but it's going to be inescapable.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dick Pullman, also with us, Dave Davies. And as I said, we are sending them out to Cleveland, Ohio to cover the Republican National Convention. It gets underway on Monday and it goes through Thursday night. And we'll be doing a lot of coverage about it as well. In fact, checking in with our two guests during the week next week to find out what they are learning. We want to hear from you. What do you want to know about the RNC? 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with Dave Davies, senior reporter here at WHYY, blogger for Newsworks.org, and Dick Pullman also blogs at Newsworks, and he's writer-in-residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing at the University of Pennsylvania, both of them going to Cleveland, Ohio next week to report on the Republican National Convention. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So here's Convention 101 for you, Dave. So what actually happens at a convention? I mean, we know what happens at night because it's on TV and people are giving speeches and it's a very, you know, enthusiastic crowd.
Right. You mean what a delegates
like,
do during the day?
What's going to happen Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock? What are they doing?
Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, there's a reception for John Kasich, as it happens, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum. There are dozens, scores of parties and receptions, many of them sponsored by, you know, corporate entities or lobbying firms or law firms, which delegates are invited to. So there's plenty of networking and glad-handing and all of that stuff. And then there are often caucus meetings during the day. I mean, I will begin the day with a breakfast caucus meeting of the Pennsylvania delegates where they will probably have a guest speaker. And it'll be interesting to see if there are any qualms expressed about the nominee or the vice presidential nominee or the speaker's list or anything else.
Are these off the record? I mean, people likely
They're quite on the record, and they're open to the media. And so, you know, not terribly newsworthy typically, but you can get a sense of what happens. And then in the afternoon and the evening, of course, there are convention sessions in which there are speeches. There's a platform which Dick has been covering. There are the adoption of rules which have been somewhat contentious. And as Dick said, I mean, the hopes for a floor fight over an anti-Trump rule has ended. So
yes.
It looks as if there will not be anything over the podium which will be critical of the nominee. But there are going to be 800 delegates there who were pledged to somebody else.
Yeah, interesting.
So that will be interesting to see. But the day is filled with all kinds of activities. And then, of course, there's the protests.
And then the protests, which I do want to get to. Going back to you, Dick, though, today Donald Trump was supposed to announce his choice for vice president. Governor Pence of Indiana seems to be the person that he was going for. But until it's official, I think we have to say that it's still an open question. One wonders, though, whether with all this focus this year, especially on both candidates and who they might pick to be their vice president, are we overstating the importance of that position, that job, that person?
Yeah. Well, you know, at the piece I wrote this morning, I went ahead and wrote a piece early this morning based on the assumption that it is indeed Mike Pence, although, as I also said, you know, who knows what lurks in the back of the great man's mind. He could change his mind at the last second. But all indications are that it is Pence, in part because I think Gingrich and Christie have more baggage than Pence. So I went ahead and said it. But what I said right in my opening paragraph,
which
I have to try to remember from memory, because what I wrote 3 hours ago, I've already forgotten.
Of course.
is basically that there are two scholars at University of California, Irvine, who have studied the electoral impact of vice presidential choices and concluded that over time, they basically move about 1% of the vote. Now, I suppose if we'd come down to a photo finish, that may make a difference, but on the other hand, you know, Hillary Clinton's choice could basically negate that. And, you know, Dan Quayle was considered a very poor choice in 1988, and George H.W. Bush won by 6 or 7 points. So in some ways we overstate it, but, you know, it's this whole idea of, you know, there's always some built-in drama of who's it going to be. So I think we've been sort of riding on that for a while. The other thing I would say about it is that, though, whoever gets picked by a presidential nominee, it does tell us something about how the presidential nominee's campaign thinks about its own, you know, what their weaknesses and what their strengths are and what they want to convey by it. And I think picking Mike Pence, who has a strong conservative record,
although
a lot of conservatives have problems with him that we could go into if you want, but the idea of picking a strong conservative with a track record going back to the early aughts in the House is an indication, perhaps, that the Trump campaign is a little concerned that they have not nailed down the Republican base yet.
Well, you know, Dave, it's interesting. I mean, it does feel like for Donald Trump, it is a family business. I mean, it seems like the children have a lot, and perhaps the wife, the children have a lot of say in who he's picking and what he's deciding to do and where he's going and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most remarkable things about the Trump campaign from the beginning is how it has functioned on a very small, intimate set of advisors and family, defying all of the conventional rules about how you run a national campaign. And it's worked for him so far. It was interesting to hear Dick describing that and thinking how there are a lot of ways to look at this choice in terms of its political impact and potential political benefit. And I'm sure that some people around Trump are thinking about that. I think it's just as true that he wants somebody that he and his family are comfortable with and that he connects with.
He and his family. Dick, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, I was just going to say, I mean, I tweeted this the other day, and if you tweet anything, it sounds snarky. But I really think this is true, that there's a weird double standard going on here. I mean, I bet that if Hillary Clinton brought Chelsea into the room and said, okay, Chelsea is going to like help interview every one of these candidates, and so to make sure that they're comfortable with Chelsea, we would be getting enormous, you know, there would be derision and laughter about it, and, you know, can't Hillary make up her own mind, and can't, you know, doesn't she know who she is, et cetera, et cetera. But we've got this weird thing now, the Trump family's involved. You know, it's like we don't even like think anymore about how we are normalizing these extremely unusual practices and what that means.
A year of extremely unusual practices, would you not say, Dick Pullman?
Yeah. Yeah, I would. And I wanted to cop to something here because I went back and looked at something I wrote in the summer of 2015. And I'm just going to sort of, admit it, that I wrote that, Trump's candidacy would probably fade by the time the leaves fell off the trees or some pseudo-poetic line like that. I wasn't the only one saying that, but I could not imagine at the time that someone with that kind of profile was going to get as far as he was. Obviously, he wasn't alone in that.
Right. And so does that mean, by the same logic, could he win the White House?
Not necessarily because...
We're talking about this on June 15th. Yes,
yeah.
But yeah, go ahead.
Well, not necessarily because the Republican electorate, I think, is very different from the general electorate. It's more diverse, and we had, a fraction of the minority communities voting in Republican electorate, and that's going to be roughly – they're going to make up roughly a third of the general election electorate. And if you look at some of the latest polls that have come out, there was one in particular that had a swing state, Pennsylvania, that had Trump at 0% in the African-American community.
Zero.
And I've never seen anything like that.
And the Quinnipiac poll showed him ahead in Pennsylvania. And today's CBS New York Times poll shows the race nationally dead even, 40% for Clinton. And so
high negatives, obviously, for both of them.
Oh, yeah.
But let me go back to you, Dave, because you're with a Pennsylvania delegate, and Trump, he took the state. I mean, in terms of – didn't he win every single county?
He won every county. Did not win the second congressional district, barely won by John Kasich, results that finally came out. But, yeah, he swept the place with no organization. I mean, I wrote a piece with a little story about this, but if you want to quickly share it.
Sure.
Pennsylvania – its delegates are elected directly by voters, so that if a presidential candidate wants to get delegates, he has to tell the voters the actual names of the delegates on the ballot, because it doesn't say on the ballot who they're for. And when I went to a Trump rally the day before the election, I thought surely he would say several times, folks, you can't just vote for me. You got to find these delegates. Here's the website where you find their names. Look at the leaflet that was handed out. He didn't mention it once at that rally. There were no leaflets handed out. And I found three women who came together as Trump delegates in the 3rd Congressional District in Northeast Pennsylvania. They won all three in a field of 11 candidates, including party regulars. They did it on their own. They paid for their own robocalls. They went to party meetings, and they won. I mean, there's something out here that's really without much of an organization at
all. Hardly
any
organization. But so what does that tell you then?
It just tells me that there is some way in which what he is doing connects with a lot of people. And I was kind of baiting Dick. I'm not predicting he's going to win the White House. What I am saying is that I don't predict anything in this year anymore. I just – it's such a strange –
Yeah,
strange
so I guess it's a question then. Is the ground game, we see these statistics where, Hillary Clinton has dozens or hundreds, of people on the ground working every day already in a lot of these swing states, and that people count up the number of people doing the same thing for Trump, and it's virtually nothing. And Hillary's got like, $20 or $50 million in advertising, and Trump has nothing. So you're suggesting perhaps that the old paradigms don't even hold anymore?
That's what it looks like. Now, I'm not predicting that he wins, but right. It is striking to me that, he has no organization and no money and no advertising, and it doesn't seem to matter.
I'm sorry, Marty, you asked the question.
No. I'm fascinated by the two of you going back and forth. But, I mean, isn't that what has been happening for the last year, though, Dick Pullman? The idea that we have a candidate, he won the Republican race, he's going to be their nominee for president, and he broke the sort of so-called rules of campaigning,
right,
especially for the higher office. I mean, who could have, as you said earlier, if Chelsea Clinton had been helping Hillary pick a vice president, people would be all over her.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that he can do all these things, and it seems that's just the Trump way.
Well, I think one of the things, this is actually sort of complements what Dave just said. I think part of the strength, I think, of what he's shown so far to get as far as he's gotten is because there is this – there are millions and millions of people who are fed up with the way politics is traditionally played. So the fact that he doesn't talk like a politician at all, he doesn't have the same kind of – we might have talked about this on the show.
We did, I'm sure.
He doesn't have the same nomenclature. He doesn't go through this. He doesn't sort of check the same kinds of boxes. That becomes appealing. The fact that, all right, people say, oh, he's a reality TV star. But a lot of people pay attention to reality TV. They don't pay attention to politics. And so when this guy in enters the political realm, it's like almost like, oh, he's a vehicle to speak to them in ways that, you know, the Jeb Bushes were taken by surprise that they couldn't do anymore.
Well, and I've said this before because I just felt like what the how he described John McCain and why he didn't support him, he did that last summer. Why that in and of itself was not a disqualifier.
That's when you knew this was different, when you can disparage John McCain's war record and skate away from it. That tells you something is different.
Well, and he's a birther. I mean, he sort of moved away from that, but he was one of the original birthers.
Don't you remember last summer there were a series of events, the McCain one being perhaps the most prominent one, where he would say something and people would go, oh, now he's gone too far.
That's it.
Gone too far.
He's done now. Right?
And, you know, but it's like there was a line in the old movie Broadcast News in the 1980s where Holly Hunter says to William Hurt, you just crossed the line. And William Hurt says, well, they keep moving the little sucker, don't they?
but Dave, you've covered Trump rallies. You've talked to people. You've talked to delegates. So sort of trying to understand the kind of support and enthusiasm that he has. And I think for people outside of it, it doesn't make sense.
I mean, I've talked to people and they say typically two things. One is what Dick said, is that we're sick of politicians. They've let us down. He's different. And the second thing is he's a businessman. He's a builder. He gets things done. And when I ask them, okay, but what about these things he said? What about Carly Fiorina's face and John McCain's war record? And then they kind of say, yeah, I wish he wouldn't do that. I wish he wouldn't do that. But the fact is he's different and we think this is a time when we need something different. I'll tell you another question that puzzles me when I look at the polls. You look at the Quinnipiac poll in Pennsylvania, and it shows Trump with a 2-point lead in Pennsylvania. There are some questions about the sample there may be. But when you include the third-party candidates, particularly the Libertarian, Gary Johnson, when he's included, he gets 9%. Trump's lead increases. If you look at some of the national polls, when you include Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, and Jill Stein, the Green, Trump does better. Bill, you're my political wizard. Explain this to me.
Yeah, deconstruct that for us.
Well, I haven't looked at Gary Johnson in a few weeks, but that would sort of suggest to me that the Libertarian model can appeal to some on the left as well as some on the right. You know, we say, well, he's just going to get conservatives who are upset that the Republicans are really just sort of doing big government stuff, and so they want the pure thing. But then there's like people who are kind of like, you know, sort of leave us alone liberals who want marijuana legalization and stuff like that, or they want a lower profile overseas. You know, they want less militarism, and they think that Hillary Clinton, as a sort of Democratic hawk or Democratic version of a hawk, you know, is not acceptable. And that Donald Trump, you know, pushing for Muslim bans, et cetera, is not acceptable. And so in that sense, you know, it's possible that Gary Johnson can become a resting place. But typically third parties do better long out from the election, you know, where it's free for people to sort of express their frustrations. And then they get down to election day. And Libertarian Party people have been saying this for years. You know, it gets down to the end, and then there's a lot of voters who say, well, I don't want to waste my vote, so I'm going to go with one of the two.
Let me read a tweet. He's from Mr. Big, as he calls himself. He says, the Trump phenomenon is strange to you sheepish liberals, but perfectly normal to everyone else in America. And I mean, there's a lot of sentiment out there, people feeling like just angry and frustrated and a lot of finger pointing. Dick, do you want to?
Well, I was going
to,
you know, there's one thing that, you know, I find very troublesome, which is, and I don't know if this, you know, I don't think it makes you a liberal to say that, you know, a candidate who has a history in the business world of not paying his bills to small businessmen and putting people out of business or imperiling their livelihoods and forcing them to go to court and settle for like pennies on the dollar and having a track record of that, you know, I don't understand how that kind of person can have appeal to a lot of working people. And I don't think – it doesn't sound like a liberal or a conservative thing to find that troublesome.
Fair enough. Let me get Walter from West Philadelphia to join us. Been hanging on patiently. And Walter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
2 points. One, the pick of Mike Pence as vice presidential candidate by Trump. Is that more of a pick or just having to choose from what's left over? It seems that most people in the party bowed out, did not want the job. So, you know, he's picking from the leftovers, Christie, Gingrich, Pence.
Sure.
Because Pence doesn't really bring that much to the ticket. I mean, he doesn't bring anything regionally. He doesn't help you with women. He doesn't help you with minorities. He doesn't bring the party together with the, you know, the Cruz faction or the Tea Party, really. Not that much of a Washington insider. He only has two terms in D.C. So he doesn't really do, I don't really see where he doesn't have foreign policy experience. So,
you know what, Walter, let me jump in here, and I hate to do this to you. It's just not the greatest phone line, and what I'm hearing you say, and perhaps let me toss this to you, Dave, saying, in a sense, Pence was a leftover pick, assuming that he sticks with Governor Pence of Indiana. What do you think?
You know, a smart businessman gets a lot from leftovers. I mean, you know, you buy failing companies, you swoop in when there's a deal. You know, I'm beyond trying to figure out how Donald Trump thinks about things. But, you know, I think Pence does help with, you know, as Dick said, the party's conservative-based. He's an evangelical, you know, he does bring some cred in those areas.
And whether that – I mean, and perhaps cementing that more conservative part of the party, Dick?
Right.
We're almost up in a break here.
Yeah, he has, although he got into big trouble with a lot of conservatives over this this bill, this religious freedom bill he signed in
for backing down
in Indiana.
It, right?
He backed down. He signed this thing, and it was supposedly give small businessmen an out from serving gay people if they if it violated their religious belief. And then when the corporate community revolted, he caved and he signed a watered down version. So there's a lot of conservative comments just in the last couple days saying that Pence is a bad choice because, you know, he doesn't fight for principles. So, you know, the jury's out whether how much he actually will help with conservatives. And he's not supposed to be also the deftest, quickest-witted speaker in the world. And he has to be able to step up on a national stage and defend Trump's comments. So we'll see how that goes.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. And we're getting ready for the Republican National Convention here on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Dick Pullman and Dave Davies, both of them heading out to Cleveland. They'll be reporting for WHYY. We'll be checking in with them next week on Radio Times as well. Both of them blog at newsworks.org. Dave Davies, senior reporter here at WHYY, and Dick Pullman is a writer in residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. 1-888-477-9499. That's the number to join the conversation. What do you want to hear coming out of Cleveland? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Andrew from Pineville to join us. Andrew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, and what a terrific panel today.
Thank you so much.
Very interesting,
Great. As
usual.
Great.
But I wanted to say that what I expect coming out of the Republican convention is that they're going to go into this thing divided. There's the extreme conservatives, which seem to be messing everything up. And then there's the upper level establishment. And then there's the rank and file Republicans. And being a baby boomer and having protested the post-war mediocrity and establishment of the 60s, I think that our generation is awakening once again. And we're going to protest the current establishment and the current status quo. And I think what's going to come out of the Republican convention is the last thing, the very last thing that any of us want is four more years of the same kind of Democratic administration.
Well, Andrew, you're saying out of the Republican convention, are you saying that Donald Trump will be coming out of that convention and that will lead to a Hillary Clinton win in November?
No, I'm saying that he's going I believe that Republicans and many some Democrats and a lot of people in the middle are going to vote for whoever the Republican candidate is, and the last person they would ever vote for is Hillary Clinton.
Okay, fair enough. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, I think a lot of Republicans like Andrew feel very strongly about that and want to do everything that they can in their power to make sure that Hillary Clinton doesn't become the president of the United States. Let me get Keith from South Jersey. Keith, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi
there.
Thank
you for taking the call.
You're welcome.
And I'll also say to Dick Pullman, some of us who still like newsprint in our hands every morning, this is writing on a regular basis.
I like to tell you my favorite political anecdote boiled way down for time and then ask you a question.
Sure.
This was told on NPR by either Ann Garrels or Cokie Roberts, a veteran Washington reporter at that high level. Right after George Bush was installed in the White House by the Supreme Court, she's in the communications center at the West Wing. She's seeing old friends. She's being given a tour. She goes past a video booth where an engineer is tinkering with bits of videotape. She says, well, what's this guy doing? And Bush's communication chief says, well, is he putting together one of those congratulatory DVDs that goes out to state parties and volunteers and fundraisers? Hooray, we're in the White House, that kind of thing. And she's seeing all of the stuff we all saw of Bush at the time, stumbling and mumbling. Put two decent,
you know,
ideas,
Keith, if you can get to the punchline, that would be great.
And here's the question.
Okay, go ahead.
The punchline is when she says, well, how can you send this out? It makes Bush look like an idiot. And his communications guy says, don't worry about it. Half the country is just like him. The question to your panel is does the Republican leadership look at America as being, well, they're half stupid, we can pull off what we want, or is the American public politically really half stupid?
Is the American people, is the public half stupid? Dick Pullman.
Oh, wow. How do I answer that one? Well, you know, first of all, I think the Republican leadership, you know, Trump was like their, out of the 16 or 17 candidates, I think he was their 16th or 17th choice. So I don't think the Republican leadership really, you know, they didn't want this. And, you know, one of the things I think it's important to remember, and it may or may not be germane in November when we look back, is that Trump got 44% of the Republican primary electorate. Now, that was enough for a plurality first place, but that was lower. George W. Bush got 60% in 2000. Romney got 52%, I think it was. So 44%. Of basically, you know, the 13 million people who voted, and that's the most fervent of the Republican self-identifiers, who are roughly like a third of the country. So, you know, for me, the verdict is still out whether he is going to grow much beyond that. And I did want to just read something very quickly, which I just saw on Twitter. You know, Trump is crowing about the fact that that the anti-Trump movement was crushed last night in the Rules Committee, and he put out a tweet about it, which was answered by Mark Salter, who was the chief speechwriter for years for John McCain and a long, long time Republican. And I'm quoting from Mark Salter. He's addressing Trump. He says, "We're still here, jackass. We'll crush you on 11-8, and you'll never get over it."
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, what that indicates to me is that there are still enormous numbers of Republicans who are very troubled by Trump's rise. And I think they believe that the majority, or they hope, and they want to campaign for the notion that the majority of people in America are not going to be prepared to elect Trump.
In fact, Dick, you quoted a New Hampshire senator in one of your
ex-senator,
who called Donald Trump a sick sociopath.
Yeah, he's a delegate to the convention, Gordon Humphrey.
Yeah, I think that stuff only helps Trump.
Well, I was wondering about that. Go ahead, Dave.
Let me just say one thing about what Keith was just saying. You know, most voters don't think about politics every day. They're living their lives, feeding their families. And when they make decisions like this, yes, it'll come to some extent down to their own policies and interests, but they're also going to just take the measure of the person who they see talking. And I think one of the things that you look in the 2000 election is that George W. Bush was a likable guy at heart. He seemed like a regular guy, somebody you enjoy hanging with. And Al Gore seemed like this, you know, kind of snooty intellectual guy who was pretty impressed with himself. And I mean, I don't know. Is that worth the difference?
So how does that work this year? I don't know.
Is that how we should be electing people?
No, but everybody gets a vote, right? And I'm just saying that impressions matter. And I think that Hillary Clinton has now, you know, 4 months to present herself to the American public as someone who is likable, experienced, and trustworthy. And that's her mission. Mm. You know, Trump is what he is, and it offends a lot of people, and it appeals to some people. But I think this visceral kind of distaste for Hillary, which you do see among a lot of people, including a lot of Democrats, is something she can work on. And I think it's going to be mostly a matter of just getting the tone right.
Is that because she's Hillary? She's a woman? she's had, what, 25 years in the public eye, do you think, that people have this hardened feeling about her?
All of that. It's a long, complicated thing. But my general sense is that in her speeches, she's somehow not connected with her own voice. She sounds rehearsed, mechanical, like she doesn't really believe it in some way.
Hmm.
I'm going to get a lot of crap for this.
You are.
I know. I mean, but I just think I've been around Hillary twice and enclosed in small groups, and she's incredibly impressive. And there's some way in which that's just not coming through. And there are a lot of reasons why she would be careful, I mean, given the long history of public life that she's experienced. But I do think that what she needs to do is to make an impression on people,
right,
and that'll make a difference.
Dick, I wonder, you're going to be going out in Cleveland and Ohio, obviously next door to Pennsylvania. Do you see, and we've got the Democrats coming the following week here in Philadelphia. What's the challenge, you think, for the Democratic Party? Then I do want to play a portion of an ad by Priorities USA. But what's the challenge for the Democrats as they come to this city?
Well, when they come here?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I would second.
And is it easier when you go after, the Republicans go first and then?
Oh, sure. I think it's easier when you go second because then you can play off of what you think were the things that the other party didn't do right. And so you can perhaps try to fill those holes. So I think we'll see some of that. But I think one of the things that has to happen in Philadelphia maybe has to do a little bit around whoever Hillary picks for vice president. You know, again, not to make too much of that in terms of electoral impact, but she needs to pick somebody who will perhaps compensate for some of the things that Dave says are lacking and also augment the strengths perhaps that Archie arguably does have. And I think one of the things that she needs to do in Philadelphia as part of this convention is to, and I'm sure she'll link it up with all our independent, you know, Independence Hall icons, et cetera, in town, is to present herself as the candidate of the diverse 21st century America, and not just of angry white people. And that's obviously the key to winning Ohio and Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact, is that they're going to need enormous turnout from people of color in urban areas to offset the people who will be going to Trump. And so those are really important. And Ohio, we always remember it's the best factoid in American politics. No Republican has ever won the White House without winning Ohio.
Oh, there you go. Let me just read some comments. I have your tweet from Victoria, listening to yet another series of pundits explaining why Trump gets to do things Clinton can't do. They're laughing. I'm a Democrat leaning independent, outraged by the disparaging comments made by Mr. Trump about Senator McCain's time as a POW. Seems likely possible that if Trump wins, he won't want to serve a full term. Will this lead to a closer examination of Trump's nominee than usual? Why do the GOP hate the Clintons so much? What did they do that was so bad apart from stopping Bush's second term? So just a series of comments there. Let me play an ad, and this is slightly edited. Dave highlighted this morning before we went on the air. This is from Priorities USA, Action Super PAC, and they are going to be spending $10 million in Pennsylvania in support of Democrats and Hillary Clinton.
I remember being in the ultrasound room and finding out that our daughter was going to be born with a disability and spina bifida.
When I saw Donald Trump mock a disabled person, I was just shocked.
You got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
That reporter he is talking about suffers from a chronic condition that impairs movement of his arms.
The children at Grace's school all know never to mock her. And so for an adult to mock someone with a disability is shocking.
When I saw Donald Trump mock somebody with a disability, it showed me his soul. It showed me his heart. And I didn't like what I saw.
Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And Dave, I've seen that ad. That's a powerful, maybe, devastating ad?
Yeah, devastating is the word I would use. And this is, by this super PAC, which is, the new phenomenon of national politics in the post-Citizens United area. They've raised $88 million to help Hillary, and they're going to attack Donald Trump with that message and others. I mean, I think it's very clear that Trump in that episode was mocking a reporter with a physical disability, and these parents saying, gosh, a 10-year-old's know not to do that. What about this guy? Does it work? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it goes to what they're obviously with the Clinton allies are trying to do is they're trying to go to this as a they're trying to hit this as a character issue, and if likability is one of the standards indeed for how people pick presidents, what they're basically trying to say is that, hey, when you get right down to it, he's not likable because we have him on film doing these things. It's not just a question of talking about him and alleging things. We have him on camera doing these things. Can I just throw in one quick
thing?
Then
we'll get Omar on.
Okay, just very quickly for everybody here and for the audience. Donald Trump just tweeted, I am pleased to announce that I have chosen Governor Mike Pence as my running mate.
Okay.
News conference tomorrow at 11.
Official. There we go. Let me get Omar from Abington to join our conversation. Omar, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi there.
One of your guests just made a comment earlier about how the fact that Hillary Clinton isn't very, like, congruent. Like, she's not very believable. And I think that's one of the reasons why Trump is doing so well, is the fact that he's so believable and congruent. And people, you know, they talk about how he speaks so frankly. But because it's congruent and that it's believable, it works.
Well, Omar, help us understand by what you mean by congruent and believable.
I mean that, like, he means what he says. He's not just selling, like, a false promise.
Let me ask you, but what he says, is it true?
That's hard to say. Like, I think he actually means, like, it's, I don't know. Because it's like you can't just take anything for face value. Like,
right.
If someone says they're going to do something, then you have to, there's a certain level of doubt that you're going to have with each person. And I think it's just higher within Hillary Clinton. Like, even though Trump says some outlandish stuff, like, people, I think they have, like, a higher trust, like, rating in terms of with Trump than they do with Hillary Clinton. But my,
well, you know what, Omar, only because I'm looking at the clock here and I know Dave Davies wants to respond to your comment.
I think Omar is onto something. Both of these candidates have terrible numbers on honesty and trustworthiness. And it was interesting to me that in the Quinnipiac poll in Pennsylvania, when voters were asked which candidate is more honest and trustworthy, Trump won by 15 points. I think it was 49-34. I think that can change, but I think he's right. That is a big issue for Hillary Clinton.
So even if what he says isn't true, the fact that he says it and says it so strongly and perhaps believes what he said,
yeah,
I don't know, Dick.
I'm going to make two quick points because I know we're almost out of time.
Yep.
PolitiFact, one of the leading fact-checking websites in the country, actually went through all the statements, an exhaustive list of statements of both Clinton and Trump, and said actually that Hillary Clinton is the most honest and fact-based of all the major candidates in the race. And this was when Bernie Sanders was still in it, too. So that's number one. The second one is, here's what Trump said last night, about the Nice attack. He said, Congress should declare war on ISIS. And so, you know, a lot of people think that sounds believable because it sounds strong, because it sounds fervent. Well, you know, President Obama asked Congress to declare war on ISIS like 2 years ago, and Congress refused to do it because they didn't want to get on the hook for the policy of they didn't want to own it. And so, you know, there's so much of what Trump says which you have to parse. But, you know, if people are not going to do the follow through, then that's to his advantage.
Well, I wish we could go on because it's been a fascinating conversation. Omar, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Dave Davies, Dick Pullman, thank you for joining us in this hour. And we will be checking in with you next week as they report from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. And yes, Mike Pence is Donald Trump's pick for vice president. And I should say, our guests will be reporting not just for Radio Times, but for many of us here at WHYY. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Stay tuned for Hour 2. We'll be right back.